Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Andrew Craig. I'm an investigative reporter and attorney based in Washington, and I've the author of Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. And I want to encourage everyone to support, listen to, and talk about the Carson's Corner show in New Jersey, which is a pioneering, courageous, and apt voice for progressives in New Jersey that I first came to know in 2009 when he was the pioneering and virtually unique media outlet willing to take on Chris Christie, dig deep, and look at how he had come to power and how he was misusing it. And 4 years, 5 years later here, that's all come to pass.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
Hi, this is David K. Johnston, and you're listening to Carson's Corner with Bob Carson.
Hi, this is Harry Kaysen, member supporter of the Zeitgeist Movement. As Zeitgeist members, we know that it is virtually impossible to find sources in the media that speak truth to power. Well, Carson's Corner does just that, and it is one of those special places where you can find out what is really going on. Not just what the bosses want you to know and think. So listen in and hear some truth at Carson's Corner. And oh, by the way, be sure to check out all the Zeitgeist and Zeitgeist-related films you can find on YouTube. We've got a world to save.
This is Les Leopold, the author of How to Make $1 Million an Hour, and I just want to tell you that you'll get a rich and rewarding experience by listening to Carson's Corner.
Hey, this is Frank Schaefer, author, writer, New York Times bestseller, but I'm here today because I've got a new book called Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, and I'm also on Carson's Corner because corporate media is so one-dimensional in terms of the kind of things they cover, that they couldn't comprehend a discussion that would begin with a statement that implies a huge paradox. But I think there's a lot of thinking people out there who understand that life is paradoxical, and Carson's Corner is one of those places you can discuss it. So thanks for being with us.
This is Greg Palast, reporter for BBC Television and Democracy Now, and author of the new book, Vulture's Picnic, In Pursuit of Petroleum Pigs, Power Pirates, and High Finance Carnivores. And you're listening to Carson's Corner on 5:30 a.m. Underground Progressive Radio, radio for the 99%. Help us occupy the airwaves and support Carson's Corner and support 5:30 Underground Progressive Radio.
Welcome live to another edition of Carson's Corner, Monday night, October 13, 2014. My name is Bob Carson. We have the chat room open for you, and if you want to give me a call during the course of this program, you can at 347-326-9749. That is 347-326-9749. Last night, we had the election boycott advocates on the show for a feisty two-hour discussion, which involved Jill Dalton, author, activist out of New York City, Thomas Baldwin, election boycott advocates member, Christopher Driscoll, and myself and Jeff Howard. And if you want to hear a great discussion, a real lively discussion, you can just scroll through the archives. It was last night. And a lot of good points, a lot of good back and forth. Although sometimes it's difficult to talk. It is. But you know what? The show is important. The effort is so important. The discussion is so important that it's something that has to be done. And it is spreading. The movement is spreading. We're getting covered by many different websites. We mentioned last night that the Greenville Post actually covered the election boycott advocate movement along with Carson's Corner. And so we're proud about that. And this is what's happening, folks. More and more people are starting to take notice because, as Jill Dalton pointed out on the show yesterday, just the idea, the very mention of an election boycott conjures up all sorts of reaction from everybody. It really does. It's a great, great topic of discussion, and it's a great response to the system that we currently have right now. And another response to the system that we have right, the economic system, is a march. And I actually participated in my first march last week, Wednesday, October 8th. We met at Columbus Circle. FIST was the sponsoring group. Fight Imperialism, Stand Together, I believe that's what it is. And we marched all over the place. And this was the first political march that I've ever been in. And let me tell you something. It was one of the best experiences of my life. It was so liberating. It was so effective because we marched from Columbus Circle. We went to various different places within, I would say, probably maybe a 20 or 30 block radius. We went to, we ended up at Radio City Music Hall. We went to JP Morgan. We went to Fox News. We went to our News Corporation. We went to Staples. The Rockefeller Building. We went everywhere. And so many people saw us, and so many people, I can't tell you, thousands of people saw our signs, okay? And most of the people in America are noncommittal. You know, they want to just watch their reality TV shows. They want to listen to or watch sports, and you know, they're not politically involved, unfortunately. You know, it's like Noam Chomsky says, if what would happen in America if as many people followed politics or as many people followed foreign affairs as they do, you know, sports or this reality show or that reality show, we'd have different results. Things would be different in America, but the very wealthy, the elite, count on apathy to, you know, essentially manufacture consent. And so, you know, most of the people probably just walked by us and you know, didn't know what exactly we were marching for. But a lot of people did see the signs. A lot of people did react to us, and we got, you know, a mixed reaction. But, you know, one of the things that it's important to do is to take the message on the road and really go to these key spots that we went to on this march that you know, News Corp and J.P. Morgan and Staples and the World Business Forum and the Rockefeller Center and the Catholic Church. All of these are players in our economy. All of these are, you can consider them institutions that have an effect on our politics or at least political issues and economic issues. And so it was really, really to do that, to get noticed like that, to be passionate, to be inspired, to get out there and go and take to the streets. That's what it's all about. And that is, you know, so important. What we did is absolutely so important. You know, if you set up at Radio City Music Hall, you go across the street from Radio City Music Hall, which is where the larger march was at 4 p.m., the rally protesting the World Business Forum, where all these CEOs spoke at the Radio City Music Hall. There was some sort of a conference there. People just walked by, and Pinko the Bear was saying that, you know, basically people by Radio City Music Hall are used to this type of stuff. You know, they see this type of stuff all the time. But if you take it to the streets, if you march a bunch of blocks, and you really show people your signs and chant, and some of the chants were just absolutely great. That's what really catches people off guard. That's what really makes people think. And that's what we did during the march. And there are so many, you know, positive points, so many great points, that every protester actually had access to the microphone. And that's just something that you don't see at a lot of protests. I mean, a couple of weeks earlier, you had the People's March addressing climate change. And you had so many protesters there that it would be impossible for everyone to speak. Well, sort of the benefits of having a smaller march like this is it allows people to speak. And I actually, not only did I attend my first rally, I actually spoke, and I'm going to play you a clip of me railing against the banksters at J.P. Morgan. I didn't know I was going to speak. It was spontaneous, and that's what we do on Carson's Corner. We have spontaneous radio shows and spontaneous speaking. And so I kind of didn't know, but I said, you know what, let me go up there and just talk for a few minutes while we were being, you know, mooned by the sociopaths over at J.P. Morgan. And I'm going to play that clip now. And when we come back, I want to talk about, it's only about a minute long, but I want to talk about why I participated in the march. And I want to also talk about the working class issues that affect everybody. You and I, folks, they're not changing. All right, so here's me in front of J.P. Morgan. I took the bullhorn, and I just want to follow up on this.
To be profoundly well-adjusted to a sick society. Well, let me tell you something. Every single person in that building, particularly the CEOs, are well-adjusted to a sick society.
Yeah.
The banking system in America represents a sick society where people are treated as human commodities. Let me tell you another thing, folks. Chris Hedges said it best. Human beings have no intrinsic value when it comes to corporate America. These folks here do not care one iota about human beings in America. They don't care. All they care about is profit. It is the mobility of money, the money sequence of value trumping the life sequence of value. And what we have to do is turn these banks into boring...
Oh my God. Did they get down? Did he ruin you?
We need to take these over. We need to nationalize these banks, and we need to institute a step tax to stabilize the economy. Because as Wall Street has become more financially volatile, so is the American economy. We need to contain Wall Street. We need to contain J.P. Morgan. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Bob.
Carson. Dude, I wish you would have told me you were going to talk. I would have started.
That was me at the J.P. Morgan Bank, the big building in front of them, while we were being mooned by these, you know, clowns in the office in the building. And it was great. There's a video of it on YouTube. You can go to my YouTube account at youtube.com/BobCarsonMMA. I got to tell you just a few things here that you know, I want to. Not everybody in the building is indifferent to human life. I mean, you have janitors, okay? You have people that have to rent themselves out for survival, just like I do, just like the police that were escorting us, just like anybody. And their values may differ from, you know, what J.P. Morgan stands for as a company. And by the way, J.P. Morgan has more assets than Walmart. They have over $2 trillion in assets. And it's just, it's frightening. It really is. But to the individuals that have the power, the CEOs, the executive staff at J.P. Morgan, individuals that really have shaped our economy, individuals that were instrumental in the deregulation of Wall Street of Wall Street that began arguably during the Reagan administration, culminated during the Clinton administration, and ended up, you know, biting us all in the you-know-what in 2008. These people have literally destroyed our economy, and they don't lose credibility. That's one of the things. It's like the banking cartels. Ralph Nader spoke about, what do these people have to do to lose credibility? You know, at what point does someone like Robert Rubin, who was lobbied away from his government regulatory post, lose credibility? what point does Jamie Dimon, the CEO, a man who, you know, almost single-handedly tanks the economy, J.P. Morgan was involved with an epidemic of liar loans, okay, robo signing, selling fraudulent mortgage-backed securities to individuals through the securitization chain. J.P. Morgan is a criminal operation. They have literally stolen trillions and trillions of dollars. Have literally, you want to talk about violence, structural violence. How many people lost their lives because of J.P. Morgan? How many people, you know, lost their retirements? The human cost associated with the financial collapse and more broadly capitalism is incalculable. It's difficult to quantify exactly how many people have died as a result of J.P. Morgan. But that is exactly what I'm talking about. That is exactly what I was talking about. Human beings have no intrinsic value to the real power brokers at J.P. Morgan. We are just, you know, simply numbers. That's it. And, you know, when I spoke about containing Wall Street, somebody on Facebook said, well, how do you contain Wall Street? How do you do that? Well, you could do that in a number of different ways. Number one, as I said, you can institute a tax. When you tax Wall Street transactions at less than a penny, you know, 0.3 of a penny or however it works out, you generate a lot of revenue to the federal government. Okay, and we had a stat tax on Wall Street going back to the 1930s, from the 1930s to the 1960s. And during that time period, Wall Street was not as volatile as it is today. During that time period, we didn't have deficits. Okay, we didn't have a need for, quote, deficit reduction. We had stable economies compared to today's economy, and that was just one way to contain Wall Street through a stat tax. Another way to contain the reckless behavior on Wall Street is what we've seen through taxation. You know, Robert Reich, to his credit, a few years ago came out with an economic plan, and I think it was worth noting. And basically, if you're a billionaire in our society, right, you're someone that has $1 billion, whether, you know, in regular dollars or in assets or whatever, there is no reason for anybody to have that much money, okay? That is ultimately destructive to our society. A billionaire, somebody that has that amount of money, I would argue is fundamentally indifferent to human life, because we have arguably a finite supply of money. All right, and one billionaire having $1 billion, that means that how many families are lacking because of that billionaire? It's like a child in a kindergarten class. One child has all of the belongings. He has all of the toys, all of the crayons, all of the chairs, all of whatever's in the classroom, and all the rest of the kindergarten class is fighting among the few possessions that are available. Well, what happens? You know, what happens as a result of you know, the hoarding of money, which, you know, you see the point there is that it should be discouraged. The United States of America does not have or does not need any more billionaires. In fact, billionaires make our society worse in so many different ways. And, I mean, we could just go down the line, issue after issue. So what you do is you tax these billionaires on, you know, what they make. You tax them at 90%. When Ronald Reagan came in, the maximum tax rate was 70%, which was historically low. Under FDR, after the New Deal reforms, FDR put the tax rate up to 92% or something to that nature. And the American people applauded him, because the American people understood that the wealthy are going to have to take a back seat to taxation, to their loathing of taxation and unionization. The America was under a threat of fascism going back, you know, to the 1930s and after World War II, or really, you know, Yeah, the 1930s up until 1945. And from 1945 to 1980 around, that was the birth of the middle class, arguably. And so, you know, when you had a high tax rate on Wall Street, when you had a high tax rate on billionaires, you discouraged speculative behavior in the economy, okay? And that is what, you know, when you cut taxes, which is what we've done over the last 30-plus years, it's now reduced us to just a horrendous country when it comes to, you know, economic outcomes and all sorts of statistics out there. When you cut taxes on the very wealthy, you inevitably have negative activities that permeate throughout society. You have massive wealth and income consolidation, okay? You have offshoring. You have mergers and acquisitions. You have union busting. You have all of the negative activities that have really come to characterize capitalism over the past 30-plus years, okay? Really in the last 30-plus years. And so we need to discourage that. We need to have a revolution around our tax code, because I believe in taxes. I gladly pay taxes. We all should. You know, taxes are the core of our democracy, so says David K. Johnson. I think there's a lot of truth to that. But if you want to just look for an example of just how out of control our system is, and look for an example of how out of control capitalism is, all you have to do is look at the United States tax code. The United States tax code is punitive when it comes to working class people like you and I. You and I get our taxes taken out. Most Americans make their money through a wage or salary. They get their taxes deducted from their paycheck before they receive their paycheck. And so, you know, we don't get to tell the government when we pay taxes. We don't get to tell the government where we pay taxes. We don't get to tell the government, you know, what we pay in taxes. On the other hand, the wealthy get to do all of that, because the wealthy have turned our tax code into a giant, junket, a giant, arguably, mode of control for them to extract more wealth from us basically live high on the hog, like they're continuing to do. Now the United States tax code is over 70,000 pages. The wealthy, the elite's response is to say, oh, we need to cut taxes, that's the problem. No, we don't need to. We need to cut taxes for certain people. We need to raise taxes on other people. You know, the people that have benefited the most from our society. The people that have exploited the labor the most in our society. Because every business owner, to a certain extent, is an exploiter. Every business owner is. The only difference is, what level of an exploiter are you? Are you a CEO who makes 500 times the lowest paid worker in your company? Or you make 30 times the lowest paid worker? You know, business owners and CEOs are exploiters, essentially. And so that's what we have, you know, and that's how you contain Wall Street. Another way to contain Wall Street is to do what Obama didn't do in 2008, is nationalize the banks. Banking institutions years ago were boring institutions with green lampshades that lent money to the community. Okay, we had a localized economy before Ronald Reagan, where, you know, you could go into a bookshop, buy a local book. You could go to a restaurant and eat a meal, a local meal. You could go see a movie, you know, at a locally owned movie theater. And the money would stay within the community, and that money would be deposited into a bank into that community and subsequently lent out to someone looking to start a business in that community. That's what banks were for. You know, and we all agree that, or I think, most people agree. I know I certainly agree that, you know, the banks are necessary. Okay, it is necessary to have a flow of capital. It is necessary to have, you know, your money deposited into an institution that is safeguarded. Okay, it's we need a way to have money. We need a way to, you know, basically print money. Okay, but the difference is what these banks do, and the activities that they engage in, what they have come to represent. And right now, our banking system is completely unsustainable, unhealthy, and, you know, that's how we can contain. That's one of the ways we can contain banks. Another way we can contain banks, and, you know, is to withdraw your money from these banks. I mean, again, you know, I support banks, the idea of a bank, but you can move your money into a credit union, which a lot of people have done in the aftermath of 2008. You know, credit unions are democracies. You can run for a chair on the board. You can do a lot of things, but, you know, that's one of the ways that you can contain Wall Street. Okay, there's a lot of different ways here. Okay, and because there's still a lot of anger towards Wall Street, that has not dissipated. People understand that the real terrorists in our society are the ones at Wall Street. The people like Lloyd Bankfein, the people like Jamie Dimon, who Obama is quite fond of. You know, any one of these CEOs that really should be in jail. But because of our you know, deferred prosecution and the Wall Street lobbyists blurring the line of criminal activity when it comes to white-collar crime, it's almost impossible to prosecute these banksters. And because you have someone like Eric Holder, who was recently the Attorney General, who came from Wall Street, has that background, as most of our so-called leaders do, represent elite institutions before they got into political office. And these are all reasons why I marched against capitalism. These are all part of the reasons why, as Caleb Maupin said, we have an economic system that is designed to reap profits for the few. We have an economic system in America that is characterized by the privatization of the means of production and distribution. And privatization, unfortunately, although privatization does have a role in our economy, privatization is built on waste and inefficiency. In order for a private company to make money, they have to, by definition, cut or reduce services. The products that the private companies offer have to be scaled back in the production process, in you know, just about every stage, because that is what keeps the profit motive going. And there's some idea, and there's some individuals out there that say, oh, you know, you guys hate profit. You guys hate the fact that people can make money. I don't hate the fact that people can make money. I don't hate profit. What I do hate is when profit trumps human need. And that is what is happening right now in our capitalist system, where the mobility of money trumps the mobility of life. It's more important that money changes hands. It's more important that we keep things valuable, which is what scarcity is, than we provide for human needs. I'll give you a good example of this right now. And this all relates back to the banks. It all comes back to the financial institutions. Homelessness right now in America, I don't trust the official government statistics because they blur the lines as far as what homelessness is and what. I mean, I'm a homeless person. You're listening to a homeless person right now. I guarantee you a lot of the people that were at the People's March Against Capitalism last week were homeless too. That's what one of the things that united us is that we all don't have a pot to go to the bathroom in. We all do not have anything to lose by protesting this economic system that we have. Well, the banks who continually foreclose on homes have all these properties available. There, it is something like there for every homeless person, there's 22 houses for every homeless person in America. We have more than enough resources in our, what, $16, $17 trillion economy that could provide for the needs of everybody out there. We can abolish homelessness. With the money that we spent propping up Wall Street, with the money that we spent on these wasteful, inefficient defense programs, we can eradicate homelessness. But we don't, because capitalism is not designed to do so. Capitalism is an economic system that says that if you're homeless, then nobody has a responsibility. You're ruled out by default when it comes to the economic calculations. And that is why Wall Street, and that is why J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and these other terrorist financial institutions would rather have homes be unoccupied than provide for the needs of society. That is a sick system. That is exactly what I was talking about when I talked about how these people are well adjusted to a sick society. That is completely immoral, but that's what we have in America. And you can extend this to every single faction of the capitalist economy. Healthcare. We have millions of people that don't have health care in this country. Okay, the Affordable Care Act is a joke. It was modeled after what Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts, and it was essentially created out of the Heritage Foundation, the idea that mandating people from the private for-profit insurance companies, which Obama deemed were the problem in 2008, that that's going to somehow solve our health care issues is ridiculous. When they are the very problem, the very problem is the for-profit healthcare system we have in America. Well, if you're sick, if you have a deadly disease, then guess what? You don't get treatment unless you could pay money. So right there, we've commoditized, we treat our health as a commodity under the capitalist system. We say that it's more important that a healthcare company make money, make a profit, than it is to give someone health care. And if you do have health care coverage, like anything in America, your amount of coverage is going to be contingent upon the money that you make. So money is everything in America. Money, the mobility of money, the possession of money is everything within the capitalist system. And it's immoral. And other countries, you know, see this. Social democracies across the world do not allow this. They do not allow, you know, private for-profit insurance companies to be the very center of the healthcare delivery system in America. And we heard from one young lady who was at the People's March Against Capitalism in New York City, who is a nursing student and got into nursing to help people, which is really, really admirable. But because of the healthcare system, because of healthcare system, healthcare companies that are banksters, that do not, all they do is skim money off the top. Your healthcare company doesn't check your temperature. Your healthcare company doesn't take, an EKG. Healthcare company does nothing but skim money off the top. They make money by denying services. They make money by canceling and by kicking people off when they don't become profitable. And it's disgusting. And it is an immoral society that's built on waste and inefficiency. And the byproduct of that is just America, how America, life forms in America are declining. You know, we have the highest rate of childhood poverty. We have the highest rate of diseases. All of the negative effects associated with capitalism are right in our face. They're right in our face every single day. You could extend this to the military-industrial complex. A wise man once said, war is profitable, so you're going to see more of it. Well, can we say that that's not the case? I mean, even under a so-called anti-war candidate, as President Obama portrayed himself as, we're seeing an expansion of war. War is profitable, so you're going to see more of it. But what does war entail? It entails dying. death and destruction, waste and inefficiency. That's what war entails. And that is good for the capitalist system. It's good for, you know, the defense contractors who are sitting outside of Washington, D.C. in the richest zip code in America. It's really remarkable, but this is why I marched. Because it's gotten to the point now where, you know, 50 cents out of every tax dollar you spend is going towards military. And the massive military spending has no end in sight. In fact, as we move closer towards a corporate state, as the ruling class use the government as a means of control to, you know, achieve the most feasible outcomes, we're going to be spending more and more money on military. We're going to be invading more and more countries because we're moving into a corporate state right now, and it benefits the ruling class. It benefits the companies that are made up of our media, you know? And so this is exactly why I marched, because it's we're moving in the opposite direction. You know, President Obama set us back immeasurably. His corporatist administration has done more damage to people like us, because now the solution, according to the elites, is to elect a more business-friendly man, even though Obama was completely in the pocket of corporate America. The solution is to, you know, elect someone like Hillary Clinton or elect someone like Mitt Romney, who's going to do even more of the bidding of corporate America, who's going to continue to gut the economy, who's going to continue to, you know, center the economy around the interests of big business. And until the material conditions of capitalism get to a point where people have had enough and they're looking for a radical solution, until a point where the material conditions of capitalism result in a mass movement that really challenges the fundamentals of our economy, then guess what? We're going to continue along the same trajectory. And this is one of the things that the election boycott advocate stands for. That's why I love having the commentary. We stand for not consenting to tyranny. We stand for not legitimizing our system, because right now, our current system, our economic system, our political system, our legal system, they're all illegitimate. They've been overrun by big money. Money has suffocated just about everything. And when you hear people like Jeff Howard on this program, who I love, Jeff, you know, I enjoy his passion. His solution is, oh, it's going to get worse. You know, we have to vote for the Democrats because it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. Well, it is getting worse, and the Democrats are in technical control. It is getting worse under President Obama, the black president who supposedly was a community organizer. What does that tell you about our system? That, you know, even someone who is portrayed as, you know, a progressive, all the isms, system continues to march in the direction it's marching. It tells you that it's inflexible. It's on overdrive. It tells you that our politicians don't mean anything. Laws don't mean anything. I mean, the wealthy, the ruling class, have so many tricks at their disposal to nullify laws that go against their interests. It's unbelievable. I mean, let's say for argument's sake that we get a national minimum wage passed. And one of the tenets at the People's March Against Capitalism was 15 in a union. Well, that's great, and I don't think, you know, anybody doesn't want that except the business community, except the fascists. But you know what? What would happen if that took place, if we actually got a $15 minimum wage passed at the national level? Well, what would happen is the business community would you know, circle the wagons. They would sue and get the cases put in front of their elected judges. They would lobby Congress to repeal such efforts. They would impose disinvestment basically not invest in our economy. Not that investment spurs the economy, but they would start, laying off workers, doing whatever they could to basically convince Americans that it's because we raised the minimum wage that that everybody's hurting. And what would result in that is a repeal of the minimum wage. That's where we're going. This fascist country, this country is more likely to repeal the minimum wage than we are to increase it. That's where we're going, because that's what the business community wants. That is what the ruling class want. Because we have to remember, the national interest of the ruling class, financial interest of the ruling class, do not align with our interests, okay? They do not. Corporate America relies on low-wage jobs. They rely on deregulation. They rely on union busting. All of the negative activities that we spoke about, and these are not in the national interest of the workers of America. These do not bode well for you and I, but we're running our economy. We have been in accordance with the national interests of the business community. And as Edward Herman, co-author of the book Manufacturing Consent with Noam Chomsky, said, it has been decided in the business community that we have to scale back the welfare state. Well, you know what? That's a brilliant statement. He's absolutely correct. The business community has been attacking welfare using the Democrats, Bill Clinton, for a long time, as if that's the problem, as if welfare, as if we're a lazy nation. Get a job, work. That's the problem with America. It's just inherent laziness. Well, you know what? You can preface that. You could preface Ed Herman's statement with everything. It's been decided in the business community that there's not going to be a raise in the minimum wage. It's been decided in the business community that we're going to continue our system of labor control, and we're going to abolish the few remaining unions in the private sector. It's been decided in the business community that we're going to continue along free trade. We're going to displace Mexican workers. We're going to displace American workers here. Okay, and further erode our economic sovereignty and further reduce our safety standards to the lowest common denominator. That's been decided in the business community. It's been decided in the business community that we're going to continue to spend huge amounts of money on defense, even though there's zero chance of a foreign country of invading America. It's been decided in the business community that scumbags like Mitt Romney, a sociopath like Mitt Romney, who is the modern day Gordon Gekko, who 50% of Americans, 47% of Americans will vote for because of their hatred towards minorities, that he has to pay a lower effective tax rate than all of us. It's been decided in the business community that corporate America has to pay nothing in taxes, and that we have to kick people off a head start, and we have to not extend unemployment benefits to make up that difference. It's everything emanates from the business community. And I'm so sick of it. I'm so tired of it, because we just keep on marching along the same trajectory. Enough is enough here. And that's why we're taking out the streets. And that is, the most important thing that you can do. It's to get active in one way or another. Move to the streets. Organized around the money that is organized around you. We'll be right back after this brief timeout here, folks. You're listening to Carson's Corner here on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Bob Carson, and we'll be right back at you.
Got no car, so I got no soul. Life is prison, no parole, no control. Food, I got my number on a wiretap. Cause I jacked for Civilac. Fuck a Cadillac, survive. One moon and no hope, cause every sidewalk I walk is like a tightrope. Yes, I know my deadline, sire. We're across the white wall. Walker seat back, a freeze in the gate.
Hi, this is Frank Schaefer, author of Sex, Mom, and God. You're listening to Carson's Corner, a show I enjoy. I hope you enjoy it, too. I encourage you to listen.
All right, we're back here on Carson's Corner. We're talking about the People's March Against Capitalism, my attendance there, and exactly, you know, what happened and why I participated in the march. And, you know, there were some good speakers there. You had Larry Holmes of the Workers' World Party. Was there, and he made a lot of good points. And Caleb also made a lot of good points, too. And I liked some of the chants that Caleb and the folks over at FIST and all of us were chanting through walking the streets of New York City. One of the chants was something to the effect of, I'm just going off memory here, racism is the boss's tool, right? I don't remember the whole chant, but something to that effect, you know. Racism is the boss's tool. This is very, very important because it goes back, I mean, a long, long time in this country, but really in modern history, in contemporary history, Ronald Reagan was great at this. Ian Haney Lopez wrote a book called Dog Whistle Politics, and he speaks about, you know, the use of dog whistle politics, how it mobilizes white voters because it basically, you know, tells white voters that black people are threatening, that the government is there to serve the interest of minorities. And Reagan understood this very well. He understood how to, you know, mobilize white voters. In fact, you know, there's even some analysis that says that, you know, Reagan got a lot of the Wallace voters. In any event, Reagan received a lot of flack for his use of dog whistle politics when he gave his supermarket speech, and he spoke about the young buck in the supermarket, how you know, they're buying this T-bone steak and, you know, you're working and he's on welfare. And, you know, everybody understood young buck to mean African-American. Reagan was basically saying that here was this young, big, strong African-American buying a T-bone steak using food stamps while you're behind him with your hard-earned money buying your groceries. And there's three players. There's the young African-American buck. There's the white hardworking taxpayer, and there's the government essentially subsidizing that bad behavior from the welfare recipient, right? And Reagan received a lot of flack for that, so he changed it to young fellow. He no longer used the term young buck, which was really a racial provocation. But Reagan's solution to this problem was tax cuts. And Reagan enacted a $1 trillion tax cut, which we still haven't recovered from today, Reagan, you know, tripled the national debt, and at the time, you know, if economic gains kept up with productivity, the average working family would be $10,000 richer today. But this is the solution to a government that is only there to serve the interests of minorities. They're only there to basically, you know, make sure that people can buy filet mignon and with their welfare stamps and really make sure that there's such agitation towards welfare. And that is exactly what Caleb and the folks are talking about, how racism is the boss's tool. It is pumped out by the elites, the media institutions out there, to get you distracted from the fact that, hey, you know what? Welfare is not a problem in America. Welfare is a very small percentage of our federal budget each year. Americans are the hardest working people on the face of this earth. I mean, I bet you people wouldn't know that based on the media coverage. In fact, I guarantee you, if you poll a majority of white Americans, they would think that welfare is a problem. You know, they've polled before. They've done the analysis on this before, and they've determined that, you know, the voting populace, this is probably going back to the 90s during the Clinton welfare reforms, that people that, you know, welfare accounts for a much higher percentage of government spending than it actually does. Okay, and it's really not true. But if you can get people to believe that, if you could, you know, continue the dog whistle politics and the racialization of American politics, then you can continue to, you know, center the economy around big business. You can continue to, you know, basically turn us into a corporate state. And that's what we have in America. And that's why, you know, this extends not only to African Americans, but it also extends to immigrants out there. Okay? Right now, there's a lot of populism that is going into immigrant bashing, and immigrants now are becoming the scapegoat for declining wages. And this is, you know, this is what happens, and it's not new. Okay, you know, during the 80s, during the days of David Duke, that you had Klan members and others marching against immigrants, and there's all these sorts of misconceptions about immigrants out there. But the fact of the matter is it's part of the same tool. It's racism. Racism is the boss's tool, ladies and gentlemen. They're not taking our jobs. You know who's taking our jobs? It's not immigrants that are taking our jobs. It's corporations that are taking our jobs. It is the narrow, self-interested pursuit of money that is taking our jobs. It is the profit margin. It is the Wall Street banks. It is J.P. Morgan. It is the tax code. It is this insatiable addiction to money that the ruling class have in our country. Now, these people are not wired like us. These people are sociopathic. Their ability to make law or to make money is a testament to their ability to skirt law. Their ability to put aside moral qualms allows them to become rich and allows them to become addicted to money, and they're indifferent to the plight of others. Studies show this. This is not just me saying this. You know, they're more likely to steal. They're the worst among us. The rich are the scum of the earth, ladies and gentlemen. They're well adjusted to a sick society. And that's what we have in America. But right now, you know, among some Americans, there's a real hostility, a real agitation towards immigrants. And it's unfortunate because it's being peddled by the same corporations that are benefiting from labor. Okay? And, you know, this is what we have to recognize. It is all part of the boss's plan, the boss's game. All right, we're almost out of time here. It's just some other thoughts here. One of the points I think that Larry Holmes made was we need to stop the war against the poor, right? We have just a constant attack on the very poor, and that exists, and that's always going to exist. But I would argue it's more reflective of the system itself. You know, capitalism is a system that is designed. You know, Peter Joseph of the Zeitgeist Movement really has some keen analysis on our competition-based system, where, you know, he speaks about the history of capitalism, how it all originated, and how you have a system that's based on competition, and there's not enough to go around, quote, and so the winners will inevitably emerge and take more of the pie, and the rest are just left, you know, to fight for themselves in the free market and everything, and that's it. So this system is designed to do just what it's doing right now. It really is. All right, we're almost out of time here. We got maybe 3 minutes or so, but I want to encourage everybody to participate in any one of these rallies coming up. I want to thank Brad Hallhart, Pinko the Bear, for inspiring me to go to one of these marches, because I'm generally a shy person. You know, I have my little soapbox here, and I love talking, but in person, I'm not a real people person, okay? And sometimes it's difficult for me socially, but you know what? Pinko's a real inspiration because he goes. He goes to these marches a lot more often than I do. And I got to tell you, it was so worthwhile. I can't begin to tell you the benefits that I received from going to this march. So big thanks to him. Also, I want to encourage everybody to friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/BobCarsonMMA. You can follow me also on YouTube, youtube.com/BobCarsonMMA. And make sure to support me on Blog Talk Radio here. By the way, Blog Talk Radio has been messing with my downloads. This has been well documented now for the better part of 2 weeks. And they assure me that my download numbers are going to start to be correct after the 16th. It's curious. I'm not a conspiracy guy, but you know what? Something doesn't make any sense. Ever since I started working with the election boycott advocates, it's practically illegal to download an episode of Carson's Corner. It's really, really unfortunate. But you know what? We're still spreading despite the resistance from the elites out there. Thank you very much. And until next time, ladies and gentlemen, show some respect.